Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Welcome to the RAND CRE Show, commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
Hey everyone, welcome to the RAND CRE Show. I'm your host, Mike Taravella, and today I'm the man, the myth, the legend, Mark McGuire. He is the VP of Investor Relations at Hearthfire Capital. Went from a LP on 20 deals to doing his own deals with his amazing partner. In the last 12 months, plus or minus 5 to 10 million, he was saying it before the call, but has raised over 13 million and has done 28 million in deals in self-storage. Mark, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Mike, that is the best intro anyone's ever given.
I think, yeah, people don't ever celebrate their success. So I'm happy to gas them up and let them know how great they are.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate it. I'm looking forward to today.
Yeah. So Mark, with everything going on in the world, you know, nothing, it's, you know, the end of March of 2022, interest rates are going up, the world's supposed to be ending, World War III, you're in self-storage. How has that been going on with interest rates going up? What have you guys been seeing in the markets? Because I know for us in multifamily, we're focusing on the 10-year treasury, but we're still very bullish on it, especially long-term. But we'd love to kind of hear the state of self-storage and what you guys' team are up to.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You're right, 10-year treasury for lending. You know, I don't think it matters whether it's multi or, you know, self-storage or it's industrial. I mean, that's really what dictates the interest rate on the lending front. With respect to the, you know, supply and demand, I mean, there's a lot of demand for self-storage right now. So there's a ton of capital that's pouring in from other commercial asset classes that had traditionally been better rated in terms of a bank's perspective on their balance sheet. They viewed, you know, office and retail complexes to be, you know, top tier, low risk debt. And, you know, that was proven to not be so true in the last 2 years. So you have banks that are really reevaluating their portfolios for risk. And there's a lot of capital pouring into the self-storage space, in addition to interest from lenders trying to rebalance their portfolios with the newly adjusted risk.
Yeah, the last 2 years has definitely been a gut check, I think, on a lot of people's portfolio. I mean, we on the multifamily side started to go a little bit newer. And I think a lot of experienced operators are going newer because they're like, hey, why would I'm willing to pay a little bit more to not deal with leaks and plumbing issues and lower quality residents when we could get 80s, 90s, early 2000s build for anywhere $10,000 to $50,000 a door more. What problems are you willing to face within this industry and get more rents for them?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. You guys have seen cap rates compress so hard, right?
Short answer, with, yes.
So you've seen cap rates just really get hammered. And, you know, I was just talking to a lender yesterday, a buddy of mine who does a lot in the agency debt space. He was like, yeah, there's people, I just been working on a deal and this group is buying in the twos. I'm like, how do you buy a two cap? Like, it's not accretive if you go and you leverage against it. So it was really interesting to hear that. Now, granted, their leverage position was low. They're only at 50%. So there's still a lot of liquidity that's burning off. You know, there's a lot of companies that, you know, whether it was through PPP or the EIDL loans that were given out. I mean, it's a lot of people up at the top in terms of the wealth sphere that really got wealthier as a result of some of these government money programs. And that capital is still out there. It's still circulating and it's still being invested in, you know, smart money just takes the money that the government gives them and reinvests it to say, hey, there will come a time when, you know, I'm going to need this, but I don't need it today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that was the whole PPP was a scramble and just going through that process. And I mean, that was for us, we got through it because it was just having good relationships with your team on the banking side, having that community bank relationship was like, hey, here's the things that are going and we need to get them in tomorrow. And so just having that rapport, and it goes back to teams and relationships like every other, a lot of the podcasts, but having that team in place on all aspects, including your vendors, is what helps you. Because then you look at now the labor shortage and everything else, you're like, you need good people around you at all times, because in the pandemic hit and everything else, it's like, it's still a struggle, but if you have the good team in place, you're going to be better off than all of your competition.
The other thing too, I mean, having a good team, I mean, the good team stayed together because they found value in what everybody brought to the table, right? You know, there were symbiotic relationships, as opposed to, you know, you just went, punched a clock and filled a role to collect a paycheck. So the good teams got stronger. They banded together, stayed together and got stronger. And then, you know, the bad teams, you know, businesses got exposed, man. That's what happens when the tide goes out. You find out who's swimming naked.
Exactly. Anything kind of on the last 2 years in stealth storage that changed, like, operationally? Because I know, kind of from my very minimal understanding, a lot of it, the more automation you have, the lower the cap rate would be for your operations. But I don't know if there's anything, like, you know, a lot of, even on multifamily, two bedrooms got advertised as like a one bed with an office or anything like that. So is there any kind of shifts from self-storage that occurred in the past 2 years that weren't really a thing?
So in self-storage, you really have five major REITs. You have Public Storage, Extra Space, Life Storage. You have National Storage affiliates, and then you have CubeSmart. Those are the five giants in the space. Yeah. They've all really made a push for more online leasing. So that meaning that tenants have the ability to, you know, basically lease a unit, sign all the, you know, sign the lease and move their stuff in without actually having to speak with or interact with a human being. Now with all the remote access technology with the gates and even now that you're seeing Bluetooth locks, even that is all starting to become more popular. The Bluetooth locks, that's, I would say, more in a testing phase to see whether or not can you catch a premium, because, you know, with it, it's more expense to build and there's a monthly maintenance expense. Plus there's connectivity that's required. So if you have, you know, electricity go down, well, can you access your unit? So minor things people didn't think about. But with operationally, I mean, it's still, you know, until you can get a robot to go and, you know, ride around a storage facility and identify a unit, identify the correct key or a master key that can go and undo the lock for the unit and then sweep the unit out, you're still going to need to have some sort of human relationship and some sort of verification that, hey, the unit is in clean and marketable condition so that we can go and release the unit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I think a lot of, I mean, there's always talks of the automation and losing jobs, but it's like you still need, we're working with humans. So unless Elon Musk builds a bot in the next 6 months of a self-storage leasing agent, there's still going to be that human component when it comes to operations, and that customer service piece is what gets people to come back.
There are still components, you know, people have tried kiosks so they can do, you know, they can do things, I'm going to say, as humanless as possible. The model in self-storage, and which, you know, effectively increasing the margin and increasing the profitability in self-storage, is being able to whittle down the hours of the person who's needed to be on site. You don't necessarily need to have someone sitting in an office watching, you know, Dr. Phil or doing Sudoku puzzles until the next customer walks in. I mean, you kind of go, you do your walkthrough, make sure there's no dumping, make sure there's no theft, make sure there's, you know, no sort of, you know, suspicious activity. Then once that's done, you're not driving people around on a golf cart anymore saying, hey, here's a 10 by 10 and here's a 10 by 15. You know, with all the technology that's available, you can kind of get a sense of what can fit in there with what, you know, from your website and your app even now.
Yeah. Yeah. The biggest push we did was like having a lot of the units that were available on YouTube, because then it's a direct link. It was just funny just hearing the conversations with our property management team. It was just like, what music we're going to put behind. I was like, it was like the corniest free music, but it worked because people could visualize how they were going to utilize that space. And it's, you know, it wasn't like huge production. I mean, iPhone worked pretty good with it, but it just, those are the things that can help, you know, those small little tweaks to your business that allows you to be more marketable but more profitable. Cause even now, like on multifamily, I'll see a lot of apartments that are like, I have to call to rent. And I'm even told my property manager goes, 0% of people are going to call you to ask for a lease. How can we do this in three clicks or less to get identified a real client that would actually want to live there?
Totally agree. Everyone's looking for less friction. And if you can remove friction from the acceptance, you will get an increase in interest.
Yeah. And that's as part of the millennial problem. I'm happy to be a part of it because it's just like it speeds. Time is money, right? I mean, yes, there is that customer service, but I'm going to care about the customer service piece when I move in and I have a broken dishwasher or fridge and the client, the speed of that versus, and to be honest, I value, like, if you have these systems in place on the move-in, I can only imagine on the maintenance requests and everything else and the move-ins and the move-outs and just taking care of our residents that way versus...
The other thing that's interesting to me is so many people do a lot of this research and analysis outside of working hours, right? So if you have a job that requires your attention, which not all do, but let's just say that more than half do. So yeah. If you have a job that requires your attention, your times when you could call and speak with a human would be in the time that you're at work, right? So then when you have bandwidth available to process your decision, it's outside of that. And honestly, if you're not providing the means by which for people to make a decision, you're just leaving money on the table. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a huge piece. Time is money and going through that. And I mean, you know, you could even go bigger on the call centers and stuff like that, but it's being there for your clientele every time. And that's what matters most, not necessarily having hours, having an office, having a cube. It's, you know, if you have someone ad hoc who's working from home and can just pop over, or even I was talking to an operator of having someone on site, because the value that they can provide of having extra eyes and ears on the property, you can't quantify it. It's like, yeah, you lose rent, but like just that two sets of eyes and ears on it, it's just super helpful and just makes the property that much better. Yeah. Mark, what are some, I think kind of the self-storage and people who are looking to get into it, what are some kind of things that you factor in a market or a particular property that really just kind of jumps at you is like, oh, this is something worthwhile to look at?
Yeah. So when we're looking, putting properties through our criteria, you know, we want properties that have the opportunity to add value. And that's a terrible general term. So we're going to define what adding value is. We want to look at properties that we can add additional square footage in a market that can support the additional square footage. So we don't want to go and add square footage in an oversupplied market where, you know, you go and you say, hey, we have more units to rent and nobody wants to rent them. That's called waste. Yeah. Don't want to do that. When we look at these units, you know, we want to go and look at something that's, you know, maybe 35, 40, 50,000 square feet that we could go and add another maybe 10 to 15,000. We would love a facility size once these square footage is, you know, completely built out on the site to be 50,000 plus square feet. That's really what we want, because you start to get really good site economics there. You start to get really good economies of scale with respect to your operating costs, because it takes one person to operate a site, whether it's 10,000 square feet or 100,000 square feet. You need one person. Maybe a second set of hands here and there to cover for the one who's on vacation, right?
Yeah.
But you really need one person. So we're looking for areas where we can add, you know, square footage, increase the rent roll, be it through additional square footage, optimizing parking, or some other leasing, you know, technique or tactic. And then we want to look at facilities where, you know, there's high physical occupancy and there's opportunities for us to move rates relative to what the current market rates are basically on day one. We want to go and see who's not paying attention, you know, because a lot of these operators are, you know, single site operators, been in the game for a long time. They have what they need. So to go and risk occupancy, to go and get a little bit more, it's not worth it to them. They have what they need. They're happy for things to just keep flying along as they are.
Yeah. It's always funny because people like the mom and pop operators, like, I know it'll make X and I don't have to do anything. And people don't consider, like, why are they leaving so much money on the table? They're like, because it's made X for so long and that's what they need it to do. You, when you buy it, it's a much different because of lending, insurance, taxes, everything that way. But they're thinking, I don't want to like a limited mindset because they're like, this has paid all of my bills my whole life and I haven't had to do a damn thing about it. Versus when you're coming in, you're seeing it through a whole other lens, which is it optimizing the parking so you can build more? Or is it, hey, there's an extra parcel of land that we can do? Like, what is that kind of like, how do you kind of filter the ability to scale with that? And is there any issues with like the city when it comes to it?
Yeah, that's all really good questions. When I say optimized parking, you know, a lot of times these facilities that we're acquiring, we're not acquiring Class A stuff that was just recently built, you know, because that's institutional grade assets, right? Where you have a lower cost of capital coming in. I mean, these people get institutions. I mean, when you get into like people that have billions or hundreds of millions in assets under management, they have a different cost of capital. And you know, they might get like the debt that these people are getting. It's like, or it's like 10, 15 year term, 30 year amortization, you know, 75, 80% loan to value. And, you know, it's life insurance companies that's doing a lot of that type of lending, but you need 20 million plus in loan volume, not asset volume, loan volume, in order for them to even consider to start getting aggressive. So when we go and we buy these assets that, you know, need the TLC, right? They just have deferred capital improvements. They have, you know, tired pavement. They have, you know, maybe no fencing or ugly.
They're a little fencing. Ugly. They're a little tired. Yeah,
they're ugly. They're ugly. Let's call it what it is. They're ugly, right? We buy ugly storage units. There it is.
Yeah.
When we do that, you know, we want to come in and see how we can configure the parking. Because sometimes there's areas that are unpaved that could be paved, and we could increase the parking spots on site to rent out. Or some places just have a big lot. They have a massive like mess of parking. Like one of the facilities we acquired in Indiana had this giant area in the back of just like loose 3/4 inch modified stone. And it was ripe for adding additional square footage of buildings. So we could take something that was parking and then we can go and add buildings on it and get a better rent per square foot, right?
Yeah.
So that's really what we're looking to do, is optimize what is on site and configure it in a way that's more effective and efficient. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think to that point, like it all comes back to leverage. So it's like if you have like the institutional, they're leveraging their balance sheet to get amazing debt. When you're looking at these deals, you're leveraging the ability to optimize that so you can get cheaper cost of labor when managing the property and getting that scale. So I think, I mean, in real estate, we talk about leverage all the time, but it can be in different forms of capital, space, and just allowing you to have lower costs per unit. And I think a lot of people always look at expenses or OPEX ratios, which I look at the number. But it's like, if you add 50 units, the game changes. It's like, all right, now we're getting more income, but also our expenses go down, which there's the added value formula right there.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're looking at it, like you said, lower cost per unit. So you're taking essentially what is a fixed cost and spreading it over a larger amount of square footage. So by, in effect, the cost per unit is going down.
Yeah, that's amazing. And this, I think it's just the simplicity of it. I think that's when you know it's, I think people overcomplicate real estate. It's like, well, if we get more units, we get more money and our expenses go down. So just the simplicity of it's just always great. And I think like self-storage, I'm not as familiar with. So it's always good to hear just like the simplistic form. Obviously there's more workings behind it, but it's always cool to see how simple it is.
What's interesting to me though, I wonder when a bank is going to start saying, hey, look, this just isn't really, you know, you have this increased net operating income, but like, we don't buy it. Like, I know that you went at, you know, made the rent roll now kick off $10,000 a month instead of $8,000 a month, but effectively the asset hasn't changed. All you've done is just increase the rents. So we're not going to give you an increased valuation. I'm waiting for the day where this whole strategy with commercial real estate gets questioned and gets checked, because we've been on this, you know, incredible wave of success for the last 10 years. If you think about it, everyone's been using this exact same strategy in commercial real estate, and value add is all it is. You know, you can slice it up however you want to slice it up, but the way you add value is you increase the bottom line, which is the net operating income. And you take that by the cap rate. That's how you do value add. However you get there, whether it's adding additional square footage or it's increasing the rent per square foot, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for commercial banks to start saying, hey, yeah, you didn't really do anything here. So actually we're not going to do this valuation. And oh, by the way, like, yeah, forget that loan. Sorry.
Yeah. I actually had this talk with someone because they have so many different filters on it. Cause yeah, it's the income approach, but then they have the comps. And then they have actually the last one is the cost basis. Cause I went to our lender and go, hey, quick question. So I've invested zero money, which we don't, but hypothetically, we invest zero money, but we double the rent to every unit. the NOI goes up, but they're like, yeah, that doesn't look good because, you know, they'll go through and do their inspections. But they had, the bank has so many filters on it of the cost basis, because they can't be like, hey, you slumlorded it, but the income and the, like, the other approach, because it is funny how, but the bank also too, on the buy side, they're looking at the cash flow from when you bought it, not what your projections are. So their risk tolerance is like, this is what it's paying today. So can you pay it? And they're, I mean, that's why it's 10 to 1 ratios and their interest rate is so low comparative to what equity is, because they're looking at it so conservative.
But the craziest thing is that, you know, you take for example, an industrial building, right? Let's just say you go and you white box the interior. So you make it all white and bright and you add, you know, an LED lights sort of brighter on the inside. And then you paint the outside so that it looks more presentable, but it's still the same piece of crap that was there, right? Like, it's still the block building that all you did was just paint over top of it, which yeah. is going to be no good in 3 years anyways. Maybe that's a short time frame, but theoretically speaking, 3 to 5 years, you're going to need to repaint it again. How can you tell me that that asset is worth double what someone paid for just because now they stuck someone in there that's paying a different rent? Like conceptually, that and, is actually mind-blowing.
And a way better sign.
Right. The people who spend $50,000 on a monument sign, then I'm just like, how did that just double the value of the property? Like,
in accounting, they call it goodwill. Goodwill in accounting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
No, I mean, it's the value. I mean, I think too, we're just in a environment as well where velocity of change is so much faster. Like, people aren't, like you said, the institutionals are coming down and buying at stuff at such a speed that it's compressing the cap rates. And then even interest rates, I mean, values are still going up because there's so little demand. People are just buying everything to hedge against inflation. So it's just the consolidation is just taking over. And change is happening so much faster, and that the banks have to catch up. And so they're like, they could be FOMO, but also, like, if you're the bank that questions everything, you're not going to get the business either. So it is very interesting. I will have a bank around to kind of, we'll have a roast and be like, we have a couple questions.
I let me know if you want to do a panel. I would gladly sit in on it and ask for the justification, because I just sit there and shake my head. I laugh. I'm like, I'll cash the check, but. Like, conceptually, I'm just mind blown.
Yeah. Yeah, it is wild, to say the least. But yeah, I mean, lending now is even, the margins have changed, even with rates going up. But what is the debt that you guys primarily use for your acquisitions? Because on multifamily, there's like the bridge, and then going to agency or using community banks. Are you guys using CMBS as like your primary acquisition financing, or is it a different vehicle? Banks.
Yeah, so as part of doing a lot of, you know, smaller kind of construction and stuff like that, CMBS, as I see it, is like when you're fully stabilized and you're clicking on all cylinders, then CMBS is an option. But if you misstep even 1 ounce with CMBS, you're sold into the bond market, they send you to a servicer, you end up in like forgiveness hell, and you never get forgiven, you just get feed to death. So CMBS, as I look at debt, is not my option.
Yeah.
If you were to go and look at on the other side, we don't have agency debt, so we don't have Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. We don't have that. You would have Lifeco, which is, you know, life insurance company. So what life insurance companies do is they have to reinvest the free float, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Which is all the excess premiums beyond a certain amount they have to keep liquid to go
their money room.
Exactly. Man, the endless supply of capital that is freaking life insurance. So Lifeco is coming out of office and retail. So they're one of the big ones that's repositioning. But they'll get really aggressive on fully stabilized projects. So they want to pursue brand new construction, stabilized lease up deals that, you know, like a private equity company will come in, just buy at C of O, which means buy at the time that the building's constructed, not leased up. They'll buy it. That company will lease it up, because they're an operator, and then they'll go and they'll do like a takeout loan at with a Lifeco, and they'll do 70, 75, maybe even 80% loan to value. You can get a 30-year amortized loan for like 10 to 15 year term. I mean, you can get crazy good debt in those assets.
How do you define fully stabilized in self-storage? Because for us, it's 90 physical, around 90 economic for 90 days.
So there's a debate within self-storage where, you know, since you have such short lease periods because they're all 30-day leases. You know, there's debates on, you know, is it 90% physical occupancy, 90% economic? So you have like, so in multifamily, you have, you know, you have physical occupancy and then you have loss to lease. In self-storage, we have physical occupancy and then we have economic occupancy. So it's the same way of saying that exact same principle. So
yeah,
92% physical, 92 to 94% economic. Gotcha. I would say that that's kind of generally where it stands.
Okay. Yeah. I just didn't know if it was like 95 because Americans just have a ton of stuff.
I mean, that there is that.
How do you guys kind of read a market to find if there's a need for it? Because I think like, I mean, you read every article on housing in America. It's like, we need more of it. But like, is there a resource that you guys use to kind of get to know markets with that? And do you do nationwide? You said Indiana, but are you guys...
No, I mean, in theory, we could do nationwide, but we're in the Mid-Atlantic and the Eastern Midwest just because that's where our contacts are. I mean, we have, you know, good contacts with boots on the ground. And we have good contacts with our management company, good contacts with the brokerage community. So it all comes down to having the people that, you know, right?
A dream team assembled.
Yeah, exactly. With respect to the assessing a market, kind of comes down to a couple of things. Number one, you know, it has, so we're not this person that's like, hey, let's buy in a path of progress and pray. You know, there has to be core principles to a market that we really like, which would be, you know, we want to have, you know, certain stability in that market. We don't want something to be like, hey, this is the next hottest thing. You know, everyone right now is chasing the Sun Belt. Like,
yeah.
And I mean, look, migration patterns don't lie. I mean, they are what they are. Like, and there's good reason to want there. But, you know, people, I had a good buddy of mine that chased swampland in Florida, bought swampland, and then, you know, the market tanked and lost everything he bought. So, you know, what goes up must come down. But if you buy in markets that are established that have, you know, good diversity in terms of jobs and companies that are there, and they have good fundamental, there's a foundational need, like where we're at, like we're kind of looking at like more logistics towns, areas where you have, you know, it's not like high income where you have tech, where you have, you know, medicine necessarily or pharma. This is more logistics based where you have, you know, yeah, industrial and logistics companies, manufacturing companies, where, you know, good markets, bad markets, they just have years. It's not like they have a year where they're crushing it. They just make money in up markets, down markets, and in between.
Yeah. No, it's opportunistic in like the economic, right? Like industrials and multifamily have been on an absolute tear the last 3 years. So it's like, okay, well, but what other, you know, in those manufacturing plays, like how do we serve those storage units and those facilities? And yeah, it's like, it's not going to be like an 08 and 09 or like, hey, let's go to Detroit and really help those markets because those are killing it. Like it's, you know, what industries can you serve that have the highest economic, like minimize your downside risk economically?
Yeah. I mean, when we use a tool called Radius Plus to help us when we're analyzing a deal to look at, you know, what's the total supply in the area. And we that's, Radius Plus isn't the gospel. It's like gives you a good 10,000 foot view of, hey, what are the facilities in the 3 mile and the 5 mile ring? Because really that's what you're competing in the 3 and the 5 with self-storage. And then you have to understand flow of traffic, you know, and the attractions around you that are bringing and taking people from where your facility is. So why would people need to store something at your facility? What portion of population are you serving and what types of things would they be storing? Are they storing boats? Are they storing RVs? Are they storing, you know, just general household goods, because the more rural you are, the larger you want your average square foot per unit to be. The more urban you are, you want it to be smaller because people have less stuff in their smaller apartments than they do in their 3,600 square foot house on an acre of land in the secondary tertiary market.
Yeah. No, that's a good piece. Cause I think it's, who are you serving? And then we do that with multifamily, who's living here now, who is going to live here. And then making it to that piece, you can't just throw numbers out there. Like if you're getting market, we toured a property and we're like, well, if you do long-term in this particular market for it to make a 4-bed, 4-bath make sense, it has to be like a larger family that can afford a couple grand. Like, well, that doesn't fit this market. Like you can't just throw a number out there. Hope, like you said, hope and pray. But it's just know who you're selling to and what that business plan is look like and see what the demographics of, is it white collar, blue collar, because those are on I think you can find those pretty relatively easily as well. But Mark, appreciate everything. I want to be respectful of your time, but we always ask our guests, what is their one investor pro tip that they can walk away with? I mean, you already have a ton of value, but what's your one pro tip to be a better investor?
The one question I always like to ask, I think that people don't ask enough, is if we fail on this project, and where do we fail? If there's one thing that drags this project down and you know, like takes it down with us, what takes it down? What's our biggest risk?
I ask that question every single time. How does this deal fail? And I love it.
So do I have to give another one? I repeated yours.
No, I that's such a powerful question because everyone goes, hey, rents are going to be $3,000. Or like, is it the market is too small where we only have one property management company and we're relying on that? Like, there's always a reason how a deal can fail. But it just, like, everyone thinks it's not going to be your admin goes up $50. Like, is it the ability to execute? Is it a heavy lift? Like, it's just like a very powerful question that no one really asks themselves when they're doing a deal. And that's like my favorite question to poke holes.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think that question is good, whether you're looking at a deal for yourself or you're looking at investing in somebody else's deal, right? Because if the person who's running a deal can't answer that question and answer that question pretty quickly, that means they haven't thought about it, which is a sign of a bad sponsor to me.
Yeah.
Like that's you, because as the sponsor, like you got to be laser focused on what your biggest risk is so that you can monitor the risk, so that you can, you know, pivot if need be.
Yeah. My bonus question on top of that one that I've been asking a lot lately is, if you had all the equity in the for a deal, no, you get no fees, no nothing, would you buy this deal? And people have been hesitating on that one. I'm like, you wouldn't buy it. And I laughed. And they're like, why are you laughing? I'm like, because you just want the fees and run. So that's been another kind of question I've been asking, because if it's a good enough deal, you'd be like, yeah, I'm all in on this thing. I would put all of my equity into this if I could, but I can't because I don't have it. Versus like, yeah, I'm going to take the act fee and run. So that's been another good question I've been asking lately with people and investors. And it's been very interesting. No one asks it. And so there's a lot of hesitancy that I found that shouldn't be existing. So, but Mark, appreciate being on the podcast. What is the best way our listeners can reach you, except for the 2 weeks you're on vacation?
I will be nuking my inbox, considering it blown up. Yeah, best way that you can honestly reach me is, investingwithmark.com. There's a contact form there you can fill out and set up a time to hop on a call.
Awesome. Well, if anyone has questions, appreciate everything, Mark, for being on the podcast, adding tremendous value as you always do. If anyone has questions for me, MikeT@RANCRE.com. And until then, we will see you next week.
Get an 11% rebate at Menards. Keep your house or deck clean with Mold Armor products. Featuring built-in microband technology for enhanced cleaning power. Tackle your decking, siding, driveway, or any surface with ease. Mold Armor House Wash cleans mildew, mold, and algae stains. Plus, it's easy to use. Just spray and rinse off. Save big on cleaning products at Menards. Number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers, according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Save big.